sound is.
Nick, we've had some pretty amazing actors and comedians join us on this show. Have there been any highlights for you over the last year or so?
We've had plenty, Tom. Mm. And the highlights, look, there's too many to rattle off. But look, Licascia always stands out. Mm. He's always very active.
Yep.
George Caponaris is always there as well. Mm. He's quite funny. I think he's used some of our material now and then, hasn't he?
Has he really?
Yeah, I thought.
Do we get royalties for that? What, how does that work out?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Mary Kustis as well to help you out. Angelo Taruja. They've been fantastic guests, haven't they?
Excellent. Yeah, you're right. And we've had most of the genre of our podcast has been comedians, hasn't it?
But not just comedians. We're talking about actors as well, because a lot of these people have done serious roles as well, or, you know, worked with serious projects and have done absolutely amazing work as well. And believe it or not, we're about to add another one today. You ready for this one?
Excellent. Bring it on.
All right. Our guest is a Greek-Australian TV, stage and film actor, writer, producer and director who hails from Melbourne. Where else, right? He's played in films such as Wannabes, Kangaroo Jack, but is perhaps best known for his role in the Wogboy films, where he played Nick Giannopoulos' on-screen welfare-loving cousin Theo. Remember the neck brace?
Yep.
That guy. On TV, he was part of Australia's now iconic TV series Underbelly, as well as Here Come the Habibs, and going much further back, Stingers, Sea Change, and Blue Heelers.
Wow. You remember all those? I remember Blue Heelers.
Absolutely. So he's a proud Greek Australian who's devoted his life to performing and teaching acting, and is currently working alongside the great George Caponaris to produce the show Life of Byron, which is what brings him to us today, Nick. So joining us in the distillery is the legend himself, Tony Nikolakopoulos. Welcome, mate.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thanks, Nick.
How are you, mate? Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you here, mate. And look, quick story before we... Yamas, please do.
We're starting early.
Absolutely. A quick story before we start, because, Tony, you're responsible for a bit of a catchphrase in our family between me and my cousin Steve. Doesn't matter what you've done, whether it's something good or bad or indifferent, it's the mainstay in the family. Good one, mate.
Good one, mate.
The best one was when we were having our second child and we just told him. He's like, good one, mate.
Really?
It works in a number of different ways. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Good on you, Tony. Hey, well done.
Oh, dear. So tell us about that scene, actually, because it's become iconic in comedy as far as we're concerned. Actually, the scene with the neck brace in the, you know, the welfare office. That
well, you know, it's just like as an actor, you take on the character and you bring it to life. And you just get caught up with it, and you're just enjoying what you're doing, and you go a bit larger and larger, and just like, you know, I've met characters like that, you know, and grown up with them, and you just push them a bit, you push the boundary to make them a little bit more comical. Yeah, but his liquids will make you
Did you know anyone exactly like that, or anyone in the family, or anything like that?
The sound of the character,
yeah,
is a little bit of my brother had that sort of a roughness about it,
right.
But then that dodginess comes from, you know, guys you grew up with. You'd see them at the soccer. You'd see them at, you know.
We all know them.
At the name days, there'd always be that dodgy uncle that, you know, that you're sort of basing it on.
Yeah.
Now, the ones that used to slap you on the back, I don't know if you remember the ones that had that big fart that they'd give you on the shoulder.
Yeah, the back slappers.
We all know them.
Classy. Did you get any flack from the Greek community playing that role at all?
People still come up to me and say, hey, Steve Manet. It's
like... And Paralympics,
No, real flack. I mean, not really.
Yeah.
I can't think of anyone coming up to me and saying that. They were offended by it.
Fantastic.
Good start. Well, let's get into the show properly. I mean, we've already had a drink, but let's do it in a more formal way. Ready?
Yep. Okay.
Let's do it. Yamas.
Cheers, boys.
Yamas.
So, what are we drinking, Nick? What are we going with?
We've got a great array here, but we've gone back to the Mini. Mini is one of our staples now. I think we've been leaning towards that for a bit. But look, we've got the vodka made from olives, as you discussed earlier, thanks to our great Greek Provador people. The gin, which we've said it's one of the best ones we've ever had, haven't we?
Stray Dog, fantastic gin.
Stray Dog, quality. And your favourite, Corfu Ouzo, eh? What's that one?
Corfu.
Lazaris. Yes.
That's it.
Lazaris.
Straight from Lazaris. Corfu. We had to have some sort of Corfu representation.
Yeah, because we don't have any on any of our episodes.
No, that's true. We never talk about Corfu ever.
Who's from Corfu?
I am. Oh. Nice. Just a little bit of bias creeping in, you know. Doesn't matter. No. Anyway.
Nisciottis.
That's right. That's it. Yeah, do you have a favourite out of the Ouzos? Do you drink something different? What's your go-to?
To tell you the truth, when I was about 16...
Here we go.
We're going to a nightclub called Chevron back then with my cousin Dennis. And we decided to scull a bottle of Ouzo before going into Chevron.
Wow. Like,
as you do, because you think, oh, yeah, I'm not going to spend, you know,
save money.
30 bucks. And let's say it was one of those chunderous nights. You know, it didn't sit very well. And I hadn't been able to touch Ouzo ever since. The whole sense of aniseed just made me go, oh, no, no, no. And I remember the first time in Greece with my uncle, he took me to an Ouzeri.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, oh, no, I'm going to have to drink Ouzo. Yeah, because you want to be polite. But I actually enjoyed it because the idea of drinking it with a mezeh makes a lot of sense. But to drink it as a sculling drink before you go to a nightclub as a teenager was a bad choice.
Classic. You probably describe most of 16-year-old Greek Australians, Tom. What do you reckon?
Well, I pinched it from the stockpile from Dad.
Well, that's where it comes from. I was the same. I got scarred from ouzo at a really young age because we were drinking it. And that's all Mum and Dad had in the shelf.
Well, you know why they had it. All those name days. Everyone bought a bottle of ouzo over. What are you going to do with 60 bottles of ouzo? They're not going to notice one missing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the funny thing. Virtually everyone that we've spoken to about this, to a T, has said they've got a story to tell about ouzo. And it's never good. It is never good.
Yeah.
It always ends chunderous.
True. Classic. But there's always a second coming. We always come back to it in our older age. And we enjoy it now. We enjoy it for the taste. Rather than trying to save money and scull it and get pissed early.
My older brother, he's taken the chipuro now.
Yes.
He loves chipuro.
That's where we've sort of moved to as well.
Oh, so really?
It doesn't quite have the same ring, chipuro talk, does it?
No, it doesn't.
For your show. No, your show's perfect. Your show talks perfect.
Tipro's a great drop. I love it. So we're from the mountains in Greece, so that's all we drink, tipro. So we love it. So we do have a lot on the show, but unfortunately we don't have any left.
I did have some nice tipro in Crete.
Really?
Which was homemade from the mountains, like you just said. And they give it to you at the end of your meal as a thank you and aperitif. And it's a thank you. They don't charge you for it.
Exactly.
Love it.
Well, shall we start up with your credentials, Tony? Yep. Tell us where your parents were from, grandparents, what part of Greece?
Okay, Dad's side are from Peloponnesia near Pylos, a village called Petrochori.
Okay.
And my mum's from somewhere not too far from there called Veli, which is, it's slightly more inland, but Dad's right on the beach. Petrochori's a really beautiful beach near Vodokilia. I don't know if you know Vodokilia. And as far as I know, I think my mum's family came from north and made their way down to Peloponnesus at some stage. But as far as I know, my dad's, the whole Nikolakopoulos clan have always been from that part. You know, and they came out individually, met here.
Mm-hmm.
I think they both lied about their age when they got here, to get out of the poverty-stricken Greece.
Really?
Met, fell in love, and had four boys.
Wow, four boys. So was it their choice to come here, or was it the grandparents?
My dad wanted to get out because there was no work.
Mm.
My mum, they sent her here with her sister and one of the brothers, and his sole task was take the girls to Australia, marry them off and come back. But he's come, fallen in love, got married first, and then worry about the sisters. So he wasn't looked favourably back by the relatives back in Greece.
Wow, there you go. And how old were your parents when they came out?
Dad, I think, lied, and he was 17. Mm-hmm. And said he was 18 or 19. My mum would have been like 16 and a bit or something, 17.
Wow. And how did they get out here? Was it the Patrice like everyone else?
Yeah, Patrice.
Wow. Oh, another one.
There you go. What year was it?
I think my dad was in the 50s.
Oh, okay. A bit early.
The 50s. And then my mum would have come a bit later.
Yeah.
For some reason, I got the number 56 in my head.
Mm.
And my mum would have been 1960 or something like that.
Yeah.
Because he'd already been out here for about 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And thought, I need to get married. I need to settle down.
There you go.
At the old age of 24 or 25 or whatever it was. It was like, enough.
That's a very common story. Like virtually everyone we've had on the show, number one, has had someone on the Patrice.
Mm.
And they've all come either 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
And, similar sort of reasons, mostly economic.
Yep.
Mm. And why Melbourne, though?
No, he didn't go. He went to the Bonegilla first, and then he headed up to North Queensland and was working on the sugar cane. And then someone told him about Yeah, he had a choice. Someone wanted him to get into a cafe in North Queensland somewhere, but he had heard about work in Melbourne, which was back then for PMG, which was Postmaster General, which was digging the trenches for the cables.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's why he came. He came down, and you know, and one of those classic sort of stories where he was the one that brought out the extended family out, and you know, paid for everyone to come out, house them, set them up. Kept sending money back to Greece, all that sort of stuff. It was, you know,
so he would have been the family patriarch.
Yeah, he was. He was. Right. Yeah.
So how many people do you think he's responsible for bringing out that clan?
Good question. Oh,
look, he's over 12 to 16.
I'd say. Wow. And imagine
because he brought his parents out as well at one stage, but they didn't want to stay. And then he didn't go back until 30 something years later. And all he remembered is he worked really hard to get the olives and the grapevines because they had all these property, what do you call blocks of lands, and he worked hard to sow the seeds and get them going so they had something to live on.
Yep.
And when he got back, his brother-in-law, so the younger sister that stayed, part of her proxy was the Stremata. And my dad's gone back and all he wanted to see was at what level in 30 years had those olives grown or the grapes. And, of course, they'd sold them all off. And he was just... He was devastated. He goes, I never want to go back to Greece again. I'm an Australian. I've got... That was his emotional tie to Greece. That what he had left was no longer there, so...
Wow.
He was devastated.
Wow.
So he became 100% Aussie.
Basically. Well, you can't take the Greek out, but what I'm saying, the thing that he felt... he had grown and created in Greece was no longer there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so there's something about that growing.
You're right.
Because we were talking to someone the other day and he was saying that some of the Greeks would bring out like seedlings.
Yeah, in their shoes.
You know, in their shoes and their cufflings, whatever. And they wanted to grow something from home here, like whether it was a grapevine or an olive tree. You know, and that for him must have meant something. So.
That symbolism of this is something from the top of
I created that. Yeah. And it's gone.
Wow. And how did they feel settling in Melbourne? Because the weather would have been different initially. With my parents, when they came out, we ended up moving from... we're from the mountains in Greece, clean air, beautiful water, and they ended up living in Tempe, which is full of factories, pollution. And my mum cried for 3 months, you reckon. She goes, what is this place? You couldn't adapt. It took her a while.
I know that in Melbourne, most Greeks, we all complain about the weather as it's like it's cold or you get the four seasons in one day.
Yeah.
But I think there's a big part of them that appreciates Australia. And always did as a home, but there's something in your heart and soul that sort of is about Greece that you can't take that away. There's a feeling,
definitely. Yeah.
The only complaint I can remember is that there would be times where they'd say, "Call Australia." So yeah, there was that, and that would be a complaint about something that was happening sort of domestically or economically or so politically. It was never about. I don't remember ever complaining about the weather.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
I suppose because they left so young.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about it, 16, 17, what do you remember?
And it probably wasn't a good place anyway.
Nah. It was poverty. It was, we'd gone through, World War II, the Civil War. The whole junta, right? There was no work for them in the villages.
Yeah.
What about for you growing up Greek in Melbourne? Did you experience racism where you were growing up?
Yeah, look, it sort of never really stops. It just morphs into something else. But yeah, totally. You know, at high school, I got to a point where I just wanted to be an Aussie. I didn't want to date Greek girls. I wanted to become as much of a non-Greek as I possibly could. You know, I went to university, drama school again, trying to sort of break that shackle. And even though they would still call me Tony the Greek, or you know, they always made a point of saying that. So they weren't necessarily calling me a wog as early on, had to learn to defend yourself. But as you sort of get older, it still became an issue for them. It's like, because you don't hear anyone saying, oh, there's Reuben the Jew. But it's okay when you say that there's Tony the Greek.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is I'd finished 5 years of studying, and I'd worked in classics and Shakespeare's and whatever, and I've come out and starting to attend auditions as an actor. You just realise that the options you're getting asked to audition for are all ethnic characters, and then they're asking you to do it with an accent. And you're thinking, yeah, but I don't speak with an accent. Why do you want me to speak with why do you want me to put on that accent? Oh, because that's what you all do. You all speak really loud and funny. You know, you just exaggerate everything. And that, you know, it hasn't totally changed today. You'll get still a bit of that today.
Would you say that as racism or just more of a cultural thing? Because I know what you mean. I grew up same sort of era as well. I wanted to be anti-Greek. We grew up My brother was a surfer, surf life saving, body soon, playing rugby league instead of soccer. But then something changed in us. You know, I think it was my trip to Greece, came back and what am I avoiding? This is a great culture. And then everything just changed from there. But I used to get called Nick the Greek all the time. I used to get called Croppo, short for Acropolis now, when that came out. End of the day, I sort of embraced it. I thought, yeah, good, I am Greek. It's good. Nothing to hide, but I understand what you went through. You probably would have had a lot worse than what we did growing up.
Yeah, look, you know, I mean, high school, they used to call me Bazooki.
There are worse things to be called.
You got called Wog or, you know, Sleazy, Greasy, all that sort of stuff. But what happened, I don't know so much in Sydney, but in Melbourne, what happened was the culture changed because the Greeks formed a strength, let's call it, and they became very feared.
You're united.
You know, and that sort of started from the sort of late 70s into the 80s. So they weren't sort of a community that you generally wanted to upset, let's say.
Right. You know, what did that actually look like? Was that those community groups or something, or was it something different to that?
There were different forms of gangs that formed, but there was just there was a confidence and a strength in the Greek that sort of form, and it was present in nightclubs, it was present in cafes, it was present on the fashion strips. And so they became popular in one way, but in the world that I was working in, it wasn't quite seen that way still. It was still seen as, okay, this is an ethnic type. Let's engage it, let's employ it, let's work with it, but let's not make it quite mainstream.
Right.
Other cultures, they were allowed to sort of be seen in a more mainstream fashion.
Yeah, right.
You know, in America, for example, it's very common for, you know, Jewish, Italian, they were just totally accepted. The Greeks didn't quite get there as much as the Italians and the Jews sort of culture. As far as stories being told, it's what Nia Vardalos has done is probably the most...
Probably is just that, isn't it?
I'm just, you know, you try and think and you can't think of anyone else.
I mean, Telly Savalas was obviously very proud of his Greek heritage and spoke about it, but I think you're right. Like, not many people actually went and tried to own the story and start to write about it and put it into mainstream culture.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah, good
you think
point.
Of anyone?
No, I can't. I don't know if it's the Uzo, but no, I can't think of anything. But.
Well, Zorba was probably the first thing that became really mainstream, wasn't it?
Yeah,
well, that's Anthony Quinn.
Yeah.
You
know, he's Mexican.
Exactly. Most famous Greek in the world is Mexican.
Yeah. You know, and that was based on a really well-written, crafted novel that was looking at what the story was about. It was very, you know, it was something that needed to be discussed at the time because it was dealing with communism, it was dealing with all sorts of issues. And it was a really well-made film. But have you watched that recently?
Yes, we did a whole episode on it, actually.
So you'd be mortified. You'd look at some of those scenes and you'd think, oh, my God, really?
Yeah. We had a really lengthy discussion about it with, who was it?
Vrasidha,
who is obviously an expert on, you know, Greek film in particular, and then also George Ellis, who, you know, knows Miki Theodorakis' music inside out. The insights we got on that episode about that text, we didn't expect half of it. Yeah. It was bullshit by the end of it.
It was. Like, just all the hidden meanings behind everything, the hidden stories.
Greek filmmakers in particular, and storytellers, they're riddled with symbolism. Yeah, that's their... I'm going to forget his name now, Theodosopoulos. He's one of the only... Yeah, he won the Cannes Film Festival. His films were just, you know, it was just symbolism after symbolism. Yeah. So you have to really... You know, there's a scene he did a film with Harvey Keitel where one scene runs for 10 minutes... And it's Harvey Keitel's character on a boat on a river, and that's all that happens for 10 minutes. But for him, there's obviously so much more in there. Right?
Yeah.
You know, where a modern day director would, you know, that would be a
that's 10 seconds.
That's cut. Let's move to the next.
Yeah.
He would love to sit there in a moment and let you ponder.
Were you inspired by texts like Azadzaki at an early age, or, you know, Zorba or anything like that?
You'd be surprised who I was. My main one that I thought from Greek, let's say if we're talking about Greek, was Stathi Psalti.
Wow.
I think we all were.
And that's because I didn't speak Greek very well.
Yeah. But you could swear well.
But there's this character, and he just swore he was vulgar, he was brash. And for me, as a teenager, I thought, oh, I love
me.
This guy.
How good
I
was
love
it?
This guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's some of the other classics like Vutzaren.
Yeah.
You know, but Psalti was something different altogether. He sort of got to a level, which is unfortunate, where people started to dislike him. But you've just got to see where, you know, what he created was quite unique.
Definitely. You
know? And his serious roles afterwards, in many respects, were even better than his comedic ones.
Yeah. He was a serious political activist, you know, which what people didn't realise. But his comedies were his crust. That's how he made his living.
He was unbelievable.
You know, and he did things that we thought, oh, yeah, but I won't say that.
Yeah.
You know, but the difference is, what a true comedian is. Yeah. He's gonna say, and he's going to push the boundary where you're either going to laugh, you're going to get embarrassed, or you get offended.
Yeah.
And you've got no choice. It's like you've got to push that boundary.
Definitely.
I've just got all these lines going through my head now. It's
true what you say there. Everyone thinks that, but you actually say it. Shit. And then you look at how does everyone react,
And I don't want to get too political, but you've got Sam Newman. I don't know if you guys know Sam Newman. Yep. He's saying, you know, let's boo the Welcome to Country, which I don't agree with. I don't think we should boo anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got people that probably are thinking the same thing as Sam. For him to say it, there are people thinking it.
Yeah.
You know, then you've got, what's her name, the Queensland politician?
Pauline Hanson.
Oh,
yeah.
Yep. You know, she's got followers. So that's from a political and social point of view. And it's the same with comedians. Not everyone believes in the whole woke society. Not everyone, understands.
But it's a cross-section.
You know, and it's like they're going to question it. They're going to push that. And I think that's what society's meant to be about. We're not meant to agree on everything. And that's definitely very Greek.
100%.
That's the whole point of democracy we're meant to argue about stuff.
Yeah, questioning. Wow. So tell us, how did it all start about with you with comedy and acting? Was it a young, how old were you when you were?
Just, normal, going to school, then realising, good, I'm actually quite good at this drama stuff. I don't mind improvising and I don't mind doing this. It's just good dressing up. And so then you're sort of toying, can I do anything with this? So then that eventually got me into uni. So I did 5 years of study.
Mm. Did you have like parents or uncles and aunts?
Oh, yeah, my dad said, come and work at Telstra. Come and work at Telecom.
Yeah.
Then it'll be after you. I remember once playing Superman in a show called Man of Steel and I was wearing blue tights and red jocks.
Yeah.
But then I went to drama school and I started to do all that real symbolic, deep, metaphorical, symbolic and all that stuff, arty-farty stuff we call.
Yeah.
And my parents would come along and they'd see me dressed as a bird playing in a play, waving my arms and, it was just one of those.
Κάτι έχει το παιδί.
Τι κατάλαβες, τι κατάλαβες.
Το δικό σου το ζωή.
Αν μου αρέσει αυτό, αυτή είναι η δουλειά που θέλεις. I took them to Shakespeare. They came to see me do Shakespeare. Yeah. Nothing. But then it's sort of like I finished that. Then I was I got offered to go back and lecture and work at the uni. So in directing shows. And I set up a production company and then sort of got into the idea of I wanted to do my own work. And that's where we come up with a show called The Last Proxy, which there was then, my dad sort of saw merit in that sort of stuff because, now I can relate to that story. That's the big key. It's about for some people, if they don't have an education or an understanding, it's about if I can relate to something, it affects me, therefore I see value in it. And that sort of took me down the path where I was caught in this, do I like acting, directing, producing, writing? I've been teaching it. So it means this, I like all of it.
You just mentioned the reaction that your dad had. Mm-hmm. Was there a moment, where he said to you, that's not a real job, you can't do that?
Oh, yeah. I remember him saying, I was at uni studying, and he'd come to see, I don't know what year I was in, second year, third year. And he said, Kali, then I finish. I can speak Greek on this show, can't I?
Yeah, of course.
Kali, then I finish. This is Flagiesk. And I think back then it was called Telecom. Telecom.
Yeah.
I said, no, this is what. And he'd say, he'd just shake his head in disappointment. Yeah. He wasn't one of those men that would over lecture. He'd say his piece, then let it go. It wasn't like, an ultimatum. It wasn't like, we're not going to support you. It was like, what you're doing is rubbish.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Did it help the fact that you had three other brothers?
All different. So the oldest one, he was more into the accounting side of way of working.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, who's passed now, but he was more, DJing clubs, then went into sort of maintenance and painting and sort of that, so he was more physical.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger one went down the path of soccer. So he played for South Melbourne for a little bit, went to America.
Really?
Came back and then he too then got into DJing and then started creating his own nightclubs and stuff. So he was sort of probably the disappointment for my dad was he would have liked him to play soccer a bit more.
Yeah.
But he was successful in his own right because let's say you're successful if you're a lawyer, a doctor or whatever, or if you're making money.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what you do then as long... Yeah, that's how they measure success.
Yeah.
But the arts is a hard one for them to stomach. As migrant, it was a hard one to stomach because
they can't relate to it.
What does that mean?
Yeah. I left poverty so you can, you know, so you have a better future. Ideas. Yeah, exactly.
Dress up as a bird. Yeah.
You know.
So when did the whole Greek comedy and ethnic comedy start to become an option? Can you pinpoint a moment when it started happening?
So I remember being at uni, maybe in third or fourth year. I can't remember if I'd finished. But that's when the show Wogs Out of Work had started to present itself, and it went crazy. It went, you know, I think there were two companies running it for 2 years all around Australia. So that was probably where everyone sort of thought, these guys have just put on what we normally do in our backyards or with our cousins or whatever, but they've made a show out of it, and it's entertaining and it's making money. So people actually like this stuff. We just thought it was just, you know, Jim and I, that, you know, it was like, you know, and then from that, sort of all sorts of shows started to birth out of that, where, I don't know if you remember the comedy company, you had Mark Mitchell at the Fruiterer, which became a sensation. Yeah. Then you had Acropolis Now that birthed out of that. From those things, a lot of things have then sort of come into fruition as far as, you know, ethnic comedy. But, you know, we did have Kingswood Country, but that character was, I wouldn't say he was...
Lex Marinos.
It was like, you know... It was more like he was a token back then. If you I don't know if you remember, put the money on the walk fridge.
Yeah,
and then from there you had Bruno Lucia, who was in a show called All Together Now, who was an Italian sort of dodgy manager who was, you know, had that sort of, you know, that sort of walk nature about him. It was like, so these characters were coming in and more into the mainstream, but the only problem was is they were never allowed to develop to become anything more than just that ethnic stereotype.
Right.
You know, and that's where I'd look at it and I think, this is fun, this is fun, but I wonder if we try something different and still keep that sort of that energy, but make it more relatable. You know, so it's not just making sort of a mockery or just trying to find the humour in it, trying to find a bit of truth in it as well.
Mm. Has that happened more so as time has gone on? Is it easier now to do that, do you think?
I don't know if it's never easy. I mean, you've just got to make an offer, and if it works and people engage with it and are successful, then it becomes easier for the next person to do it.
Yeah.
So you look at My Big Fat Greek Wedding, it's sort of doing that, but it's still relying on the good old measured gags that we've all done.
Mm.
You know, they're not unique. We all know them. And so it's about just about pushing it a bit further. There's a comedy troupe in Greece called Radio Arvilla.
Love them.
We know it.
Favourite.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's good Greek or ethnic or social comedy, and it's not relying on anything other than...
And Aman before that, which is the same group of guys.
They're not trying to overplay or overdo or send up. It's just observation. I find this funny, and it's funny for everyone. You know? That's all. But I think we tend to think, oh, we've got a pigeon that hole.
Mm.
You know, what's the surname of the person? Oh, yeah, that's ethnic. Just because of their name or just because their eyebrows, you know,
they
were instantly putting into ethnic. And then there's some people that are happy to use or promote or over-promote that fact because they're just going to draw on... They just want that crowd. Comedy and entertainment and theatre should be for everyone.
Definitely.
It doesn't matter who it's about. It doesn't matter because the character's Greek or the...
Yeah. But it has been a great springboard, though, hasn't it? You know, I mean, some fantastic names have come out of it, obviously... Wogs Out of Work, you had, you know, Nick
and Mary and George, Simon were the four main ones that sort of came out of it then, and then it's grown now. I mean, you look at Sushi Mango, who they grew up watching and admiring that. You know, now they've sort of just got gangbusters with their stuff. And then you've got interesting comedians like Joe Avardi, who's slightly different again, but doing gigs overseas in Europe and Canada and so forth. But it's about constantly sort of stretching and trying to find something new to a point. Can we ever be accepted as mainstream and contemporary? Or are we always going to be, I don't know, these are the ethnic ones.
Yeah.
That's what annoys me. That we've been here for so long. We've created and given so much. We probably represent most of Australia on a demographic point of view, but we're the least represented for our truthful stories.
Yeah.
When it comes to, you know, Sydney Theatre Company, when was the last time you went there to see a show that had a Greek?
No idea.
No, Belvoir Street, I can probably, you know, I think they have. They've sort of toyed around with one every now and then. But it's not common and nor is it on TV.
Mm.
Yeah, do you think possibly maybe there is, but because we all sort of look the same now. We've all blended in. We've married into different partners now. Might be like half Greeks out there. Do you think that's sort of, there's a blend of that in there now? Well, not really.
No, I'm not saying that there's no characters in a show that might not have a Greek heritage.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is you're never in a Greek household or never is the main protagonist character of a Greek background.
Do you think it's changing though or not really? It's still the same.
Oh, we're trying, Nick.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, but if, unless someone, we make an effort and say this is what we want to see, it's not going to happen naturally.
Mm.
If someone's got to write it, someone's got to create it, then that sparks a new idea, then sparks something else.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm just saying that's what I want.
Yeah.
To watch something that I can relate to, as well as everything else.
Yeah.
It's like you love NRL, and you can't just watch NRL for the rest of your life. You've got to look at, you know, Victorian football, like the AFL.
Soccer.
You know. Yeah. But imagine if they stopped playing NRL and they said, no, that's only for the paddocks.
Yeah.
And now you're going to start watching only AFL. How would you feel? You'd say, listen, every now and then, I want to watch an NRL game.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, I can't remember what states are in Australia, but there's been some, you know, when you go touring, you flick through the TV and you want to watch the Aussie game, the footy, whatever, and they don't cover it.
Mm. Yeah.
And you're going, what? This is before the internet.
Yeah. Correct. You know? Yeah. No, good. No, well summed up.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that it's not at all.
Yeah.
But hey, how many Greeks are there in Australia? How many? There's probably a million if you count the generations.
Yep.
There's no true representation from story point of view. Italians probably a similar thing.
Yeah.
Croatians, I can't remember the last time there was a Croatian story.
Croatian.
Yeah. We had the Lebanese. We've had but it's like the Ibrahim story, the last king of the cross.
Yeah, that's right.
But how true is that of a Lebanese story?
Mm.
At least they're Lebanese characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're doing your bit to try and make sure that that voice is still there in a way that you find palatable in the way that you want to do it. What sort of inspired you to start writing the way that you have? And obviously, Life of Byron, that you're doing with George Kapanyaris, I suspect, is a step in that direction.
Yeah, look, that's something that sort of started to develop with an idea. I saw George doing some stand-up at a place here in Sydney called Stecky.
Yeah.
Nice.
We've got to create another show, you know, because George has got, you know, there's so much talent there and people won't know, I mean, for what a great actor he is. So we sort of started talking and catching up and improvising and filming and writing and then we knew that we wanted a story to be sort of mother-son related but not sort of stand-up style, but in a way that it's theatrical, it's telling a story that there's humour but there's also drama and there's pathos. And so we sort of just develop that, and with me was the mind of, I want this to be able to be seen as it could be a mainstream show.
Mm.
There's no reason why it should only be shown, you know, in like a, whatever you want to call it, wog show, ethnic show.
Yeah.
It actually can be something that MTC or STC or the Belvoir could program.
Yeah. Mm.
And anyone could go and see it because then they can all relate to it because the story is about a mother and son, but then people would additionally relate to the fact that I can see me there because of the Greek mother or the Greek son. So there's a sort of duality purpose there as well.
Well, for those who don't know, just give us a high-level view of what the story's about.
So Byron, he's in his 50s. He's AWOL, he's missing in action because he's had his midlife crisis and he's away overseas doing what you do. He's lured back by his very practical sister, saying we need to make a decision about Mum. She's got early signs of dementia and we need to put her in a home, sell the house. You're the executor, you got to sign and put it away. And so as he reminisces and reflects through his baulo, he's haunted by, you know, past memories from as early as childhood through to sort of the, you know, 10 years ago, let's say. So he goes through first day of primary school, right through, and his mother has been omnipresent or present all through that, and he's blamed her for everything. But what he also comes to realise is that he's never really taken any responsibility for much in his life.
Right.
And so he's riddled with guilt. And the dilemma is he can't make that decision to put his mother in a home. It's too hard a decision for him. So he needs to make a choice. Can he look after her?
Is any part of this biographical?
No, look, there's a lot of George and myself in the decision making and the thought process and in some of the stories. But neither of us have got a mother who's got early set dementia. I mean, George has got an auntie that went through it, but no, it was not biographical in that sense. But there are some scenes which are very much autobiographical.
If only we had George here to ask him about it. Oh, George, is that you?
I'm just enjoying an Ursula, and I dropped in and...
I was wondering who that was in the corner.
Yeah, I was really giggling in the corner.
Welcome, George Kapanyaris.
Hi, boys. How are you? Good
Welcome
to be back.
Welcome back to the show.
Yeah.
Good to see you, mate.
I didn't forget the address.
No, you didn't.
I found it pretty easy.
Hey, it's like you just snuck in and you got your ouzo and you made yourself at home.
That's right. Yeah. What am I drinking? The green one.
The green one. Mini.
Yeah, maybe we can get him on as a sponsor, Tony. Is this a nice one? I like that one. Yeah,
it is good.
It's a beauty.
That stuff.
It is quality.
Well, now that you are here, George, tell us a bit about it from your perspective. Tell us about the aunt who.
Yeah, my aunt. Part of so the inspiration. While we were writing this, then we were given the job by my uncle. He said, "You're the executor, or do you want to be the executor?"
Right.
None of the other cousins really wanted to do it, and my wife and I took on the job of looking after my auntie and my uncle, who passed away shortly after that. And then my auntie who didn't know anything apart from hairdressing. She couldn't do anything else. She couldn't even cook and clean, you know, because she never did that. So we cared for her, and she didn't want to go into a nursing home. And she said, this is my house. I want to die in my house.
Yeah.
And basically it was a hard gig. It was like she was so stubborn, you couldn't even... You know,
Greek stubborn? No.
Yeah, no. The stubbornness is stubborn. But, we did our best. We tried our best. And in the end, we found her a place to go to, a nursing home. But she passed away before we could sneak her in there.
Yeah, right.
We tried. We had to do it on the sneaky. We had to, and she went to hospital because she fell. We were waiting for her to recover so we could just take her straight from the hospital to the nursing home.
Wow.
Sedated or whatever. It's the only way we could do it.
Yeah.
And she passed away, which was probably good for her because I think she would have not liked it. Some people love it. Some people, I was doing a lot of work for Bronya at the time, which is a company in Melbourne which cares for the elderly. And they have things like where they have clubs and where, the elderly go to have fun, mix and socially and, play games and, culture and all that sort of stuff. My auntie was not interested at all. Didn't want to mix. She didn't want to mix with old people.
Wow.
She was that sort of a personality. And it was funny that we were writing this show and then that happened. So I really had first-hand experience.
Oh, so it happened. So the show came first.
Yeah, the show, we started writing this before we got into that.
So
and
it just
I, with this
fall.
One, I was, my cousin had to care for his mum and he just dropped everything. He had a job, he's a pilot, dropped everything for 10 years and looked after his mum who had Alzheimer's. So... And he was doing things like, a grown man, cooking, cleaning, but cleaning her, dressing her, putting her in the shower, all that sort of stuff, which I think, I bowed down to him because he's, I don't think I could ever do that. I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's the questions we're all asking, whether you're Greek or not, you'd be Aussie, you're going to go through this. What are you going to do with your parents?
What were the feelings when you... Out of all of those cousins, were made to be the executor there.
I was shitty. Yeah. I was shitty about the whole thing. Why? And my wife's going, well, look, we've got to do it. There's no one else. It's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And I'm going, stuff them. Why can't they, make Step a phone up. Call? Why don't they go visit her? Because people have got busy lives. They've got kids. They've got their own families. They've got probably their partner's families to care for. They don't have time. People don't have time these days. So I guess, it was lucky that my wife and I were there for my auntie. And, she didn't have kids. So we became her kids in a sense,
Well, reading about the show and hearing about it, I couldn't help but feel that everyone's been touched by a similar story when it comes to this sort of thing. And I think that's what's going to get people more than anything to buy into it because they're going to see part of themselves in it. Is that a fair assessment?
It's an aging population and, we've got really busy and fast lives. So there's going to be a lot of that going on, what is the right decision? What makes you feel right? And that's a big part of doing this. Also, the big challenge for me is to the acting side of things where I'm not doing stand-up, easy, good old stand-up. I'm actually doing serious acting. I'm doing some comedy as well. My delivery has to be different to a stand-up comedian. So when I'm doing, there's a lot of monologues in there where it takes us through a journey through time. Mm. So from a 5-year-old to become a 15-year-old to a mid-20s to, you know, divorcee to a single again to a, you know, it's a huge challenge. Also learning a script, which is so big. Like I was telling Tony the other day, he went, what? I went, you know, halfway through the rehearsal process, I'm going, how can I get out of this? Like, yeah. Like, can you win Tats Lotto or something so we don't have to do this? Because it wouldn't sink in. Yeah. There's so many costume changes and changes of character that it was daunting.
Yeah.
A couple of nights, you know, my wife's going, you'll be fine. You know how to do this. You're the best at this. Just do it.
You're waking up in a cold sweat.
I don't think I can do this. How am I going to? I was saying to Tony, can you just ring a bell or something so I know it's the next thing? Like, wow. Now it's like drinking water. It's ouzo, I should say. Drinking ouzo. Yeah. It goes down really easily. But 2 weeks ago, I was just sweating.
Really?
Really sweating.
Yeah, look.
So huge challenge and great experience to be acting with my co-actor, Maria Theodorakis, who's a, you know, a kind of NIDA type of actress, you know, AFI winner, theatre actress, works for the STC, MTC, you know, a different style to me. Mm. So it's been, we clashed a lot of times because we had different styles, but we're working each other out and we're blending beautifully. Mm. So it's not like working with, you know, one of my, you know, comedy mates.
Yeah.
It's a different level,
which
is a great experience for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tony, you say you're a writer, a producer and an actor. Do you actually, when you're producing, do you clash with the actors? When you're directing, does it ever happen? I'm sure it does.
It
depends. He's very patient.
I'm very patient. Director. I'm diplomatic. Mm-hmm. I understand what the actor's going through.
Mm-hmm.
The whole process is quite collaborative. So you've got to find a way of speaking their language or finding their language or read when you can sense they're getting a bit insecure at that point because sometimes it's
something
else.
The first couple of days with Maria was like a boxing match. It was like sizing each other out.
Really?
You know, trying to, where we can take a jab, where we can, you know. And Tony was coming in going, hey, you're right. You calm down. It's going to be great. Don't worry. He just kept on reassuring both of us.
Mm. So what were you arguing over? Is it?
Just different styles.
Okay.
So I've got a habit of,
just explain
if I can't remember the line, I just improvise my way through.
Right.
Maria's going, I need that line.
Yeah.
Got it.
You've got to give me that line or I can't do the next line.
Yeah.
That's how I work.
Be better, okay,
George. And I'd work them individually. So I'd go off with Maria and have a chat to her and say, you know, this, and, you know, whatever. It's like pep talks.
Yeah.
And I'd be doing the same thing to George, but without them realising. Because what happens when your insecurity takes over as an actor, you start to think that the other person's actually disliking me or not trusting me or doesn't believe in me or doesn't have faith, and you're just trying to get them out of their head and sort of work together. Like sport. You know,
I think the first day I insulted Maria because we did a read through, and I've gone, you're not going to do like that, are you? Which is the worst thing to say to a
great for confidence
MTC actress. You're not going to do it like that.
I
go, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Because normally if you're in a band, play it in G, don't play it in A. Yeah. You know, it's just, we just throw them out and then we move on. And I'm held under that for a few weeks.
Wow. Classic.
And then a couple of weeks later she goes, don't tell me how to hack one of those. And then from then on she's just been directing me for the last 4 weeks. It's like, but I don't say anything. I just go, great idea, Maria, great idea.
It's hard. Look, you know, you got Maria who's, she's a Cretan.
Yeah,
for that
say no more.
Right?
Yep.
But she's a strong, you know, opinionated person who writes, acts, and directs.
Okay,
which is great because we've got some good fiery scenes as well.
Yeah, so George also writes and he acts. And then you haven't really directed, but you sort of direct your own stuff.
Yeah, it's not my thing.
You've got people that have got opinions. Mm. They're not just waiting for you to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
So therefore, you're going to get a sort of a better quality of work out of these people because they're offering and they care and they want to, you know, they want to constantly make it better. They're not interested in just tell me what to do.
Mm.
You know, tell me how to say it. When you know, not waiting for you to say, oh, you're good. You're doing it really well. They're sort of self-criticizing themselves and correcting themselves all the time. So, yeah, it can get a bit murky at times, but it's for the better of the show. Mm. Yeah.
It just sounds like from a director's perspective, you'd be like, you'd have to be the best football coach ever because you're it's managing exactly different people and trying to get the best out of them.
Yeah, you just, you've got to keep them on song, as I say, you know. It's like, it's just keep them trusting and working and listening to each other and allowing them to feel like they're being heard.
You have to trust the director's vision too. And sometimes when you're on this side, you don't know what he's seeing or she's seeing.
Yep.
Sometimes it maybe might feel wrong, but from that side, it feels it's right. Like we've got two halves in the show, and I kind of preferred the first half. And then Tony just kept saying, no, the second half's great. Again, I don't know what I don't prefer the first half. I don't know what. But now I'm kind of loving the second half more because the second half is the better challenges have come up in the second half. The first half is easy.
Yeah.
For me, the first half is basically, you know, what I do naturally.
Yeah.
Second half, I'm challenged.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because we've had a few people come to the rehearsal to watch. They've all said that we really love the show. It touched us and whatever. The first half's great, but the second half, there's something that I really love the second half. So they enjoy the whole show as a whole. The first half holds.
Yeah.
But the second half does something. Yeah, it takes them to another place.
Yeah.
It's relentless when you're doing it. And I go, okay, phew, got through that one. And, oh, no, there's this one now. Oh, and there's this one now. Oh, and there's another one. So it's kind
there's
of
no
like
real break. You just
there's not a break. The level, it's like playing a video game. The level goes emotionally up in time until we finish. The first bit of the second half is a really hard scene as a performer, really tough scene. And I get out of that and I go, show's over. No, it's not.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. This is the yoga scene.
Yeah.
All right. I've got to do this now.
So much like life.
Like life. Yeah. And that's why we call it Life of Byron, not only a play on the Monty Python
thing. Is it
thing.
Draining, though? Is it like? Is that what you're saying? Like you get to a certain point and you're acting so much and when you sort of come down, it's draining?
It's almost like...
And you got to lift yourself up again?
Imagine you're a soldier and you've defeated one tough fighter, then the next one comes up, and then the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one, until...
Yeah,
you knock the microphone, you win the war, or whatever it is, or you're a football player and you've kicked a goal, now kick another one back.
Robin.
Keep going.
Yeah,
okay.
And that's what the feeling is. It's and the adrenaline kicks in, of course, and it takes you through. And it does feel when I'm in there that I'm actually living the life of Byron. I'm going through these different ages and phases, and not one scene is like the other. Yeah. Where I go, that was a bit like the last scene.
It's And how long does the show go for?
In time.
Yeah.
Look, two halves. It should be about 45-ish minutes each half with an interval. And the interval's great because it gives the audience a chance to go out, think that they're going to go in and then be taken by surprise by where the show goes next. And it's only like two-week seasons. So we've got a two-week in Melbourne and a two-week in Sydney. It's short, but, we sort of want to leave an impression so that we hopefully can come back and do it bigger and better next year with...
Yeah.
Maybe some support from some of the mainstream theatre companies.
Okay. It'd be great to do it at the Opera House somewhere which is a non-WOG event, mainstream, so we get everyone seeing it because it's everybody's story. It's not just a Greek story.
So it goes comedy and then it's a bit serious and then comedy and serious. Is that what it's
all
like?
All the way through.
Nick, it's like life.
Far out.
One minute you're laughing. Next minute you're stressed. Next minute you're upset and you're crying about something.
Just imagine what you go through with your kid. They've just been through the teen years.
Yeah.
It's a tough time, isn't it? And then it's okay. And then something else happens. And then it's okay. And it's
It sounds like a fascinating show. Like I said, I couldn't relate to it because my dad had dementia. We went through all that process. And everyone's ringing me now when their parents go through it. Nick, how did you handle it? Who made the call to get them to a nursing home and all that sort of stuff? And how bad is it? I think most Greeks has the guilt thing about sending their parents to a nursing home.
Yeah, I'm the total opposite to my character. I was like, come on, let's just, to my wife, please, let's
have some logical
lens on
this.
She's not looking after herself. Please, let's just, no, come on, let's try.
Yeah.
Exactly,
because we made the call on behalf of my mum. So my mum was looking after my dad. He'd fall over, and then I said to my brother, I said, listen, we're probably going to lose mum before dad the way things are happening.
Yeah.
So we had to make the call for
it. And that happens.
That happens
too. But, and that's what we talk about, and that's what Byron is experiencing. He's experiencing that guilt.
Yeah.
And that's why he can't make a decision.
Mm.
And that's why he's struggling to make a decision.
Yeah. It's an even tougher decision when you consider the mentality that Greeks have towards that conundrum. Because if you go to Greece, no one does that. Nursing homes, like there are nursing homes, but very, very few people utilize them. People are taking time off work completely. They're stopping work, as you said, George. And they're looking after their parent. There's like,
It's a Western thing.
Yeah. The other side of it that we haven't spoken about is the tithapito chorio kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh. There's that side of it. There is that side
of it. But there is a bit of sense in that too. So we're in Greece just recently, and the sense I got out of it, they're very communal people.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, the old saying is the village raises the kid. Mm. Like, it's so true there.
The village now is looking after the young.
Exactly. You know, yeah. You know, here we're very isolated. Yeah. We don't have that. Even though we're all Greek, everyone's busy doing co-curricular
stuff. Because, you know,
stuff.
If you've got to work late, you know the next door neighbour or the theatre down the street will come and kick in for you, and it won't be a problem.
Correct.
Which, you know, my mother-in-law was from Earlwood. That sort of happens.
Yeah.
Yep.
But if you're living in Bondi,
yeah,
and you're, you know, your mum's in Parramatta,
yeah,
and it takes 2 hours to get there, that's a tough call. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to make sure they're looked after before they fall over, break a hip, and then you got more problems. So what do?
I don't know if you've heard of the island Ikaria.
Yeah, yes. Definitely.
Which is Blue Zone.
Blue Zone, yeah.
You know, and that's because, I mean, they can't quite pinpoint it to one thing, but one of the major things is that everyone has a purpose at all times. And I think that's a big key here, is that we work so hard, we get to a point where we're sort of saying, okay, now you're retirement.
Mm.
And in retirement, you're trying to find things to do, but there is no purpose.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you might have asked to look after the kids. It's probably the only purpose you get. So you've got your gipple, you've got the idea that I've still got stuff to do. Like, you know, I'm helping out at this restaurant, or I'm helping out at the school. I think that's a true thing. It's like,
good point.
And that's where some people have that argument. I don't want to put him in the home, because if I put him in the home, they'll die, because there's zero purpose there.
Yeah.
And that's the complication now, is of what is the right decision.
Yeah. Mm. Dimension's a tough one, though.
Yeah.
Because when you get to a certain level, can't walk, can't do anything. So you got to be a 24-hour carer. You know? That's where it gets tough.
That's a tough one.
Look, I picked up the Mithras village. That's where I really noticed it. Like, it was such a community thing.
Mm.
We go to the town centre, and people who don't work at the restaurant were getting up and helping. If they saw they were busy, they were serving, they were doing this, doing that. Kids would run off. You know, no one would flinch because the neighbour down the road's keeping an eye on them. Yeah, like, that's where he lost it at one point
because my little bloke just disappeared with a football in hand. He's like, well, where is he? I'm like, he's probably just gone to some house behind here. He's playing football with his mates. It doesn't matter. It's the only place I would ever be confident enough to say, I can't see him, but I know he's okay.
Yeah, the platia.
Yeah. But I'd get that feeling if someone was elderly in that community, that everyone would be helping out.
Yeah.
It'd be the neighbour, you go do your shopping, I'll keep an eye on her, I'll do this, I'll do that.
But what happens in Athens, you know? What happens in
Troy.
The Thessaloniki, the bigger places. So
unless
you're there, you don't know. So
I'm not sure what Greece has got as far as aged care. I mean, I'm sure they've got it.
They do have it. They definitely do have it, but it's either a pride thing or that sense of responsibility where it's like, put your parent in a home. You know, they raised you. Mm. You've got to look after them, kind of thing. We had a similar conundrum with Dimitras Yaya. I mean, she was more or less paralysed, you know, for the last 5 years of her life. By Australian standards, she would have been in a nursing home 10 years before that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Here, though, my mother-in-law was going from the restaurant to the house to turn her multiple times a day. They were paying people to come in and look after her because there was this whole thing about we can't put her in a home.
Mm.
She needs to stay at home. We need to look after her.
Yeah.
Very different mentalities.
But that's great that you've made it into a show now, because a lot of people will be able to relate to it.
Yeah, and ours is also talking about it's early stages of death. It's like just the first signs.
Yeah.
So we haven't gone to that next level. And so the show's very much about, that's the catalyst for sort of bringing these two into a drama.
Mm.
But it's also what does it do to Byron?
Mm.
It makes him reflect and makes him think, and he realises, hey, my mum's been there every part of the way, but I've been a prick to her every part of the way, you know. And that adds to his guilt, you know. He's got a widowed mother who never moved on, and she's done everything she could for him, but all he sees is that she never did enough for me. So there's that. That's the emotional string that goes through it as well.
The story.
So I just want to go back to rehearsing and you, George, you know, working with Maria. Were there many rewrites when it came to rehearsing? Like, did good stuff come out of sitting down with Maria and workshopping a lot
Even
of stuff?
Even last night we had a Zoom and Maria went, nah, can we change this? I just want to say this. Okay, all right, let's have a listen to it. And we compromised on something between the three of us, but we're still going. We've used Sally, our writer, who's still going, sending us paragraphs and paragraphs. Can you put this in? Just put this in. I think,
is there going to be an end to it?
No, there's an end. There is an end. We're talking about little minor tweaks now. Like, we're talking about, you know, a line or two. But you've got to understand, over the course of the period, there's probably, we've written maybe 6+ hours of material. This is what it's sort of trimmed down to. So we had stuff about Lord Byron in there. We had
ancient history,
all sorts of scenes that have gone that are not relevant.
We had an 18-year-old scene and a 21-year-old scene, so we merged the two together. You know,
we had a magic scene where, you know, really? we had an audience into participation scene in the very early on.
Yeah, I remember that.
With puppets.
You
know,
we thought that was a great idea.
It's evolved. You know, and that's part of creating something and collaborating is that it's like you start with as much as you can and you condense it down. It's a bit like picking a good footy team. How many do you need to start with? About a good 50 to get down to?
Squad of 50.
Takes you down to how many?
NRL, 17.
There you go.
Starting.
Squad that's what 20. It's like, you know. You want too much.
Yeah.
And you just realise, it's good, but it doesn't help.
I've got
three of those things, and they're all saying the same thing. We only need to say it once.
Just pick the best one.
So you got it restricted by time, do you? You got to get it to.
Plus, you don't want the audience to go, oh, I've heard this before. Is this?
You don't want the repeat.
Everything has to be fresh, isn't it?
Who ultimately tests it in terms of saying, "Yep, that's definitely in." Is there a review process where someone within the group says, yep, that's, you know, that's definitely in? Or in comedy terms, the Marx Brothers used to take the show on the road before they'd do a film. You know what I mean? So,
well, I mean, I sort of would say that the director has like the final say, but in a very diplomatic way.
Yeah.
And then once we've presented this and we've had our two-week run in Melbourne and then in Sydney, there'll be an edit done at the end of that as well. And that will come from just from the feedback, just from having watched it so many times, that, you know, you start to see where the thread has come loose a bit, and I think we need to tighten that a little bit.
We've also done a few, before we started rehearsing, how many readings did we do in front of
friends? We've done about three or four readings.
So we read the script in front of a group of people, and they give you an opinion of, you know, what they think it sounds like, what it could sound like.
These industry people or people?
Industry and friends.
Let's go back to your body of work now, Tony, because we love the fact that you're here, George, but we haven't had Tony on before. So.
Jeez, boys.
Siniyamas. We spoke briefly about Wog Boy at the beginning. Where does that film sort of sit in terms of importance when it comes to looking at ethnic comedy? I mean, it did amazing things in terms of...
Look, surprisingly, at the time, it did really well box office-wise. So no one was expecting it to do as successful as it did. And like I said, it drew the audience that sort of like that related to it and they could understand it. And it was on not on the stage, but it was on the big, big screen.
Yeah.
You know, I'd have to say I was very surprised by the reaction that it got. You know, both, you know, the financial success and the people that sort of like, yeah, come up to you and quote and sort of get excited about that film. But for me, I suppose from that, I was hoping that was going to lead to stronger work, like to take, you know, it's sort of like the Wog Boy 2, the Wog Boy 3 sort of carried in this almost like, a bit like my Big Fat Greek Wedding. It didn't go that next level that they could have. You know, for me, it was like, you know, imagine if you saw those Wog Boy characters in the first one. Imagine if it led to the point where you see Steve Karamitsis married with kids, with, you know, a family, rather than he's, you know, still going to nightclubs, which is funny, but but there's so much more to find about evolution. About how we grow.
It's a good point, actually.
Very good point. I think it would have been a good show. Maybe you should start a
different franchise.
What I'm saying is that I'm not saying show's better or worse, but I'm saying is that our work should always be evolving because we are.
Yeah.
There's someone that's done really well is Christopher Tsolkis. You know, the Head On was one of those movies where it took it to the next level.
Yeah.
You know, the whole migrant story.
Yeah.
And there should be more of that. And there should be more quirky stories too, you know. My Greek neighbor's an axe murderer. Something like, we've never done that. You know, something that just goes off the planet. Why not? Why don't we do, why don't we take these risks? Well, in Australia in general, with our storylines, we've never had something that just goes that next level. Yeah.
Did Greece ever play villains?
Yeah, all the time.
It's always the Russians.
No.
Like James Bond. I'm thinking James
Greek
Bond.
You were in Greek villains. I've played lots of Greek villains.
But oh, really?
Yeah, there's lots of Greek villains. You know, if you watch some of the American sort of FBI series, there's always a Greek.
Ah, okay.
The Wire.
The character I'm playing now in Local Council is a Paul Fenwick show.
Oh, yeah.
It's about to start on 7 Mate and 7 Plus. I'm playing a mayor of a council.
All right.
And he's dodgy. And he's Greek, sorry. Sorry to all the Greek mayors out there.
Is it Sydney or Melbourne? What council?
We shot it in Petersham. So Petersham Council. But it's not Petersham. It's called Darradong. So I'm a bad guy, but I'm actually a lovable bad guy. Greek is my vehicle because I'm in a Greek body. But could have been any... Was any it nationality this
modelled on Salim Mahaja, maybe?
My deputy mayor is a Lebanese guy.
Really done.
And that's John from John Sinem, Bernard. You know John Bernard that does all the World Cup soccer stuff?
Right. Yeah.
And Vince Sorrenti is my mentor.
He's a podcaster, isn't he?
He did the thing where he went to the World Cup and he was just heckling all the different supporters.
I think I saw him in Mykonos as well.
He does a lot of rugby. Is he an ex-rugby player?
Yeah, I think he played rugby league for Lebanon. Yeah,
and he's got a twin brother. Yeah. So they create havoc and all sorts of stuff. But
very funny.
So, and of course Vince Sorrenti, you know, he's one of my idols in Australia in ethnic comedy. Mm. So before me, Vince was doing stuff, you know, and we looked up to Vince. So it was great to work with him.
Greek villains, eh? Greek villains.
Well, I was only thinking of like James Bond. There's always Russians or something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, through the 80s. There's been a Greek villain in a James Bond film.
Which one?
The one that's been shot on the island with the casino.
Casino Royale?
Yeah, there's Greek villains, don't worry.
Wasn't he Albanian? The guy with the scar on his head?
I can't remember now, but I remember there's been Greeks.
Okay. Well, speaking of villains, what about Underbelly? Because you were part of that one as well. That was the second movement.
Yeah, that was the Tony Mockbell, Tony. So it was funny, that character there, I don't know if you can call him a villain. He's, you know, he just lives outside the norm. Tony Mockbell's best friend who gets him over to Greece.
Mm.
The funny thing about that is I was sitting in a cafe in Templestowe and this guy comes up to me and it was his dad that I played. But his dad had passed away, I think, in jail or something. It was interesting because he was happy that I played his dad. He wasn't he wasn't like, he didn't feel offended or upset, which was sort of, you know, it was nice to sort of get that.
So do you meet people from, say, the underbelly, underworld to get into character?
Look, my early years working as a bouncer and sort of frequented enough nightclubs and I've probably met enough gangsters to know. Look, they're just, for me, they're very charismatic and charming people. You just don't cross them. You don't, as long as you're not in business with them, that's when, you know, and that's what it is. And what we see on TV is the 10% of their life is probably really corrupt and violent. Yeah. The rest of this is not that.
When Underbelly came out, we just went, oh, that guy. He used to be at, what was that club we used to go to in the casino?
Heat
nightclub. Oh, that's the guy that I was used to say hi at the corner of the nightclub. Him. I had no idea. It was just a guy.
Yeah.
Hey, how you going?
How did that feel for you guys, you know, coming from Melbourne, to say these are people and characters that we know of and that we would pass by and, you know, they were just normal people?
I grew up, you know, I live in that area that, you know, Alphonse lived in, you know. And, you know, Mick Gatto, my brother went to school with Mick Gatto's son.
Wow.
I know Mick. You know, we see these people every day. You know, how are you going? What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. But there's that other side that we don't know about until it comes out in the movie. Oh, right, okay.
So it's fair to say it's just their occupation, maybe.
Yeah, look, it is. It's just that's their business.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I see them every day. But when you see them, it's just like it's, you know. And you know that they're involved in some capacity. You don't know the details, but you don't question them either. Yeah. You know, it's not like when you're talking to them and You say, how's business?
No, you don't ask. Just don't ask questions.
Just talk pleasantries.
That's a nice suit.
Yeah.
You know.
Weather's nice today.
You know, and I've got a good mate who was part of that in the police force when Piranha Squad were around, and I can't remember how high he got up, whether he was second or third. And, you know, even him telling me some of the stories, they all knew each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember going to Carousel.
And the underworld.
Yeah.
They know each other. They'll have a drink with each other.
They drink at the bar with each other. They just
Wow.
It's almost like two footy clubs, you know.
It's like where do I read that?
It's like the Roosters with the, you know, St George players just having a drink after work.
Yeah, true. It's like a game of chess in the way, isn't it? Mm. So you all become mates, but it's just the game. And if you get caught, you got me. You win
this, I'll give you a bit of that. It's like, you know, bartering and as long as you're not snitching.
Yeah.
Per se, as long as you're not crossing that, there's a line. You know, but underbelly, I think, getting back to that, is something that, you know, from the sort of the word that I heard was Eddie McGuire and talking to Mick Ghetto about that book and saying, do we have the blessing or, you know, that sort of thing. And it sort of started. And then once we started filming, there was all these legal issues that were coming up because a lot of the characters were still alleged.
Okay.
So there was rewrites on names and so forth.
The court cases.
And they rushed it, but it worked. Yeah, Andrew Kittis did a great job, and it sort of took off.
Yeah.
And then it became a franchise. They just did these sort of sequences of underbellies that just kept going.
Mm.
It was you got something coming up which has got that flavour. Can you talk about that yet?
Okay, so yeah. Well, Peter Gawler, who wrote Underbelly and Last King of the Cross, approached me about a project that he wanted to create for me, which Andrew Kittis will direct, and it's called Call the Greek.
Okay. Oh, really?
I get to play the Greek.
Yeah.
But it's about a disgraced cop who gets kicked off the force and sets up an agency with his five daughters and his wife, and they deal with things that no one else will deal with. So it's got that soprano, it's comedy, it's got underworld, it's got all those flavours, and it's set in Melbourne in Collingwood.
Fantastic.
And, you know, the character is,
that sounds great.
Played for about 3 months for Collingwood Football Club, so he's... You know, he's a diehard pies man, which is not great for me. But,
you do your support.
Cow!
Damn it. I'm like sort of
but
a
closet. But the good thing about that is it didn't come from me. It came from a non-Greek who said, I want to write this for you. And he's a really well-respected and award-winning writer.
Mm.
It's got a great title called The Greek.
Yeah,
and it's about a Greek family. But there's nothing, it's not an ethnic exterior, you know what I mean? It's going to have real heart, soul, drama, comedy.
So is it a mini series or a movie?
It'll be shot as a 10-part series.
Initial thought process. Wow. And either, 7, 9 or 10 will pick it up Netflix?
It'd be more for cable. See, with the free-to-air, it's hard because of those commercial breaks.
Okay.
When you write it, it depends on the style of the show.
Yeah.
It doesn't. To break it up with commercials, it's not great for a drama.
Kings of the Cross was...
that was Paramount.
Paramount, yeah. Which is great. It means there's work for us again, you know.
You raise an interesting point because so much of what's going on now is being done specifically for streaming now as well with, you know, Netflix and Disney Plus and all that sort of stuff. Has that affected the way that people are writing now and, you know, the format for series now?
Well, I mean, when you're writing a series now, each episode is almost like a little film in itself. So it's got that filmic quality now. Yeah, it's written like a film, written more filmically than it was episodic TV.
Mm.
So you've got your Neighbours and Home and Away, which is a serial, which is written in a sort of a formula where you can tune in 3 weeks later and you haven't missed much.
Yeah, catch up.
And they have beats, between each ad break as well. This is like...
It's written with ads in mind.
Yeah.
But when you're creating something with the idea of it being on Netflix or Stan, the whole idea is that it should feel like by the end of this one episode, is like a film, let's say, you're sort of eager to stream and sort of go into the next one.
Yeah.
So what it does is just create this need for...
it's like binging. Continuation.
Yeah. Yeah. Like binge. How many times have you binged something? You just got to... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's because there hasn't been those ad breaks.
Yeah.
You've watched and you've engrossed, you've been engaged. It's sucked you in. So by episode 3, you're thinking, I've got to get to the end.
Yeah.
I need to know what's going on. I need to know what's happened.
Wow. So it's called
the beauty
Greek.
I don't know if you ever saw Money Heist.
I never saw it, but
the Spanish one.
I've seen it pop up. I haven't seen it yet. Really, watch it.
You can't. You got to go to the next episode. But there's a lot. That's just one example. You know, of a lot of them. Blacklist is another one that got me. The American one. If you saw that.
What was one that got me? Breaking Bad. That's what got me.
I was depressed when it finished.
Yeah.
And I was binged through the whole thing, and then I went.
I don't know if you saw Ted Lasso.
Yes.
Yeah.
Loved it. It was frustrating, Ted Lasso, because I wanted to watch the next, but you couldn't. You know, so what I did with the last one is I waited till they all landed.
Yeah.
And then just binged them all in one night.
In a day. Yeah.
See, I debated whether I should do the same thing with the new Star Wars series on Disney.
Yeah.
Because I love Star Wars. So they've got the Ahsoka Tano series now.
Yeah.
And it comes out every Wednesday. It's driving me mental.
Yeah. you have to almost like leave a Wednesday and then come back and watch two in a row.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's what it's done to you, though.
Yeah.
It's like it's making you feel like it's one's not enough. And they've picked up on it.
Yep.
Right? And their algorithm or whatever it is. And that's why they're now slow releasing.
Yeah.
Because it's about how long can they hold you on contract for? Because they know that every contract's is a month long.
Yep.
And you're going to sign up for an extra month for a particular show. But so there's all that game playing because people are switching from Paramount to Netflix to Stan. They're playing that game a bit. And now sports come in and playing a big part. And they've separated sports, so you can't watch it just on one channel. So you've got to go to OptiSport for EPL and you've got to go to KO for that one.
You've got to have everything now.
To Stan for that one. So, why isn't it all on one channel, all the sport?
That's right.
That's what they're doing. And Disney's very smart the way that they've separated theirs, and they've got different streams within the one stream. And
So The Greek, it's called.
Call the Greek.
And do any idea when it may come out?
It's a hard one to say, but I wouldn't be surprised if we're up and running at some stage next year.
Wow, that's pretty
cool. So we got that, and
have you started recording and doing?
No. It's just still in the writing and development stage now.
Okay.
Then we've got another one that we're writing with Chris Anastasiadis, who Chris wrote all of the Wog Boy stuff up until Kings of Mykonos, then sort of. But he's written films that are indigenous films. Like he's a great writer, TV writer. But we're working on a true story based on my brother who played soccer.
Mm-hmm.
They entered the Five-A-Side World Cup Championship in Seoul in 2002. As a bunch of just Greek boys, that were nearly 30, 29. And they think, we'll just play Melbourne. If we win Melbourne, we go to Sydney. But they won Victoria. They came to Sydney. They won Sydney. So they went to Singapore. And they won Singapore.
What?
So now then they're off to Seoul. So they're starting to take it seriously, training. And they get to Seoul and they win the World Cup against America. But never got really any acknowledgement here because it was during the time that soccer was being ethnically cleansed.
Yes.
Right? They didn't want any WOG association. How are they going to promote these six Greek boys and a Jewish coach winning the first ever Australian World Cup in soccer anywhere?
I had no idea that this happened.
They didn't promote it. So that's being written and we're trying to get that up.
Can I just ask you a bit more about it? What year was that?
The 2000, the story starts, and I think the World Cup was in 2002. It was Seoul, whatever year Seoul
was. Yeah, that was 2002.
Okay.
2002.
And your brother, and any other players that we may recognize?
Kimon Taliadoris joined the team towards the end.
Yep, I know him, yeah.
Sam Meyer was the coach who worked with Ferenc Puskas and was working at the AIS for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
He was Polish, Hungarian Jew.
Yeah.
Chain-smoking Sam. Jamaranis was part of the team. There's us you wouldn't know. No, the others you wouldn't know.
Really?
And one Chilean. There was one Chilean guy who played for the Aussie Futsals, but they kicked him out he didn't get picked and he ended up playing in the team that knocked out the Aussie official Australian Futsal team as well. So not only did they knock out VIS, AIS and the Futsal, whatever they're called, they knocked out all the Australians, still hadn't been given an official jersey by Australia.
Wow.
Had to organise their own. But they've ended up in Seoul. And
they won the whole thing.
Yeah.
What a story.
At the very least, there's a documentary in there that needs to be made.
Yeah, look.
Maybe there's a podcast in it.
That is huge.
That was before social media too, so there was no...
Yeah. Look, I think they got back and they put him on the footy show for about 30 seconds, where the guests sit.
Yeah.
And they just sort of waved. And that was
it.
Kidding.
Yeah.
That's a huge story.
This is your brother, your younger brother. Yeah. What's his name?
Peter Nicolopoulos.
Yeah. Go Pete. Well that done, mate.
A huge story. This is a...
I'm going to look into that more.
Yeah.
Far out. I love all those stories.
Yeah.
Well, there's plenty going on for you,
yep.
for both of you, and you know we're so glad that you've taken the time, you know, to come back and talk to us, George. And
it's Tony, been a great afternoon,
Tony. For you, for the first time, where can people watch the show? Where can they follow what you're doing?
In Melbourne, we open on the 11th at the Alex Theatre in St Kilda for 2 weeks. Then here,
11th October, that is.
And then at the Factory, where from the 31st of October to the 12th of November. And if they just go to www.lifeofbyron.com.au mm-hmm. or on the socials.
Or ring up, we'll check that out. Factory Theatre, yeah. I guess.
Yep. And we're part of the Greek Festival here in Sydney.
Fantastic.
We'll just Google you. I'm sure you're all over there if we Google you.
Yeah. Or just look at George on Facebook. He's putting something up
every day.
Regularly.
That's our job.
Classic. How many times do you get Life of Brian mentioned?
I never make the mistake.
Yep.
I always say Life of Byron.
Yep.
The actors make the mistake
every now
purposely
and then.
And sometimes not purposely.
Sometimes we just call ourselves George instead of Byron. So yeah. Get away from doing that one.
And that's purposely put there because the life of Brian is
very comedic.
And we use that as a working title, but it's also about a Jewish mother and son trying to find out who his dad is. You know? The only one in this one, he's not trying to find out who his dad is, but he wants to know who he is, in a way.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully Life of Byron isn't banned in as many countries as Life of Brian was.
Yeah, it was banned, wasn't it?
It was.
It was.
Bankrolled by George Harrison,
that film. That's right, George Harrison from the Beatles, yeah.
The most expensive movie ticket ever, apparently. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't know the story?
No.
Eric Idle went to him and said, you know, we want to make this film, but the BBC's, you know, backed out of it. EMI's backed out of it or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to him, George goes, I'll give you the money. It's George, it's like, you know, what was it, like $20 million or something like that? He goes, I'll give you the money.
Yeah, so he was like the executive producer, wasn't
he? So they made handmade films, that company. He's like, yep, I'll make this company and I'll give you the money. And the film got made. The most expensive movie ticket anyone's ever paid.
Wow. But he would have got that back. It did well, didn't it?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Well. Yeah. This is George Harrison. We're talking Beatle money here.
Fantastic.
Anyway, digress. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being on Resort Talk.
Thank you very much.
All the best with it.
Both of you.
And we can't wait to see it.
Oh, good.
All the best with it.
So November 1 to...
12th.
12th.
So first 2 weeks of November in Sydney.
Yeah. Perfect.
Wonderful.
All right, done. Let's lock that in, Tom.
Done and done. Well, mate.
Good stuff.
Nick, great to see you again, mate.
Awesome,
mate. Another episode down. We're closing in on the half century.
We are.
It's nearly 50
episodes.
That's
fantastic.
I can't believe that.
50 eps. Great.
That's it.
Me and you.
Raise the bat, mate.
Us
raise
the clowns. 50 episodes. Unbelievable.
We're nearly there. Well.
Good stuff.
UzoTalk@outlook.com is the email. Check us out on social media at UzoTalk and at Uzo_talk on Instagram. Nick Athanasiou, George Kapanyaris, Tony Nikolakopoulos. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Yamas.
Thank you, gents. Yamas, boys. See everyone.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.